True friends are hard to find. I think we all understand that to be true. And the truth is, they become harder and harder to find the older we get. When we're very young, friends come easy. In fact, sometimes we don't even have a choice. Our parents simply introduce us to someone and say, here's a new friend for you. And away we go. Or maybe you're at school and the kid by the water fountain is now your friend. Or the kid that just invited you to their birthday party. So we have a lot of friends. Again, sometimes not even our choice. They're thrust upon us. In fact, little kids have so many friends that they have to have special categories for best friends versus just your other regular friends. But then as you start to grow up a little bit, some of those childhood friendships are easy come, easy go. And so when you get into the adolescent or teenage years, suddenly you find a narrower group of friends, but those friendships become very, very important and very significant in the shaping of your life. So much so that sometimes teens need to be warned who they make friends with. Girls, for instance, will talk on the phone for hours with their circle of friends. Boys, on the other hand, tend to together with their buddies and do really stupid stuff together, which is generally how it happens. This is also the time of life when new terms are introduced, things like girlfriend and boyfriend. But then after high school, what tends to happen is a lot of us tend to go our own ways and separate. And so those friendships that were forged during the teenage years suddenly are separated by many, many miles. And in many cases, the number of friends narrows even further. Now, college gives us an opportunity for more friendships or new friendships. But even then, we see a narrower pool. Then, if you're blessed with a husband or a wife, that spouse can be a lifelong friend to you. But if by the time you're an adult, you begin to realize just how special and how rare true friendships are. Friendship means risk. It means investment. It means making a priority of someone else. A friend is that person who will show up for you when no one else will. They're there to help. They're there when you need them. And the number of friends may shrink over the course of our life, but it really makes you appreciate those who really are. So if you have 1, 2, 3 good friends, thank God today. I was reading that in the United States, slightly more than 1 in 5 millennials, 20% of millennials, say they have no friends at all. The situation is just as bad in other countries like the United Kingdom, where 3 in 5 people between the ages of 18 to 34 say that they are regularly or often lonely. And there's such a plague of loneliness in today's interconnected, internet-driven world. Yes, you can talk to people across the ocean, but it doesn't necessarily translate into friendship. Right? Friendships are so hard to come by, we now have services to provide that. This week I got onto rentafriend.com, which is modeled after dating sites, but instead of having a long-term romantic relationship in mind, it's a casual platonic friendship. So you can rent a friend for as little as $10 an hour, or if you live in a major population center, maybe as much as $40, $50 an hour. But you can rent a friend. And here's some of the suggestions on what you can do with your friend from the website. They say, well, you can rent a friend to accompany you to a movie or a museum or a concert. Have a workout friend to give you incentive and support. Attend a business or social function as a guest you're invited, bring them as a guest that you're invited with. Go to a restaurant with you if you're uncomfortable dining out alone, and the list of possibilities continues. So even though we are instantly in contact with any number of people, we find ourselves more lonely, more friendless than ever before. Yet here's the really good news, is that those who have met Christ, who know the saving love of Jesus our Savior, we have a friend who endures, one whom the Bible says sticks closer than a brother. We have a friend who is so faithful, who all of our sorrows will bear. In John chapter 15, Jesus says something remarkable to his disciples. It's right here in John 15, verse 14. He says, "You are my friends What an amazing thing for him to say. Here, on the eve of his own crucifixion, Jesus addresses these 11 men and says, "You are my friends." That's hard for us to wrap our mind around. And please note, he's not just talking to 11 men. He's talking to all of those who through the ages will love him and follow him. He says, "You are my friend." So today, if you are a follower of Christ, this title applies to you. You are his friend. Friendship with the Lord involves the highest responsibility, the highest privileges, and the highest duty. And we will see that in our passage today, that those highest responsibilities, privileges, and duties. In other words, friendship with Christ is not a casual acquaintance. It is a relationship with depth, with privilege, but with certain duties that go along with it. And the idea of friendship is really what underpins this whole section of verses 12 through 17, which we're going to look at. Now, we've been walking through this farewell discourse of Jesus and have noted along the way that this is not just a kind of a recited, you know, formal legal statement Jesus is making. This is a speech filled with pathos, filled with feeling, as Jesus expresses himself not in a, you know, carefully worded official transcript. In fact, one thing we've noticed about this whole section is that it's kind of cyclical. Jesus will say something, and then maybe 10 verses later, he'll come back around to the same topic again. And then maybe in the next chapter, it comes around again. And again, I think it shows us that what Jesus is saying here, he's really trying to hammer home some very important things into his disciples' minds. And so just like when you're driving a nail, you don't hit it once and drive it. You hit it repeatedly, and that's what Christ is doing. One of the themes we've seen is love one another. And that pops up here as well, as we see the responsibilities of friendship. So speaking to his friends, Christ is speaking to us. And he has several important things to tell us, and that forms our outline this morning. So if you've got a bulletin, if you're able to fill in some of those spots, let's look at what Christ says to us. Number one, the Lord has issued you a command. And the command is love one another. Love one another. Pick up in verse 12. "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends." Now, if this sounds familiar, it's probably because we already read a very similar statement back in chapter 13. 13:34 says, "A new commandment I give to you, you love one another just as I have loved you. So you ought to love one another." So really, there's nothing new being unwrapped here. It's a repetition of what we've seen before, and yet one that we very much need to hear. Jesus is giving a new commandment, which that ought to give us a pause for a moment. Who is it in the Bible that is able to give commands? You think about the Old Testament in particular. Who is it that gives law, that gives commandment, that gives instruction to his people? It's the Lord God. So by Jesus saying, "I'm now giving you a commandment," he is in a sense saying, "I am giving you with all the authority and with all the rights of God himself, I command you to love one another." So this is a kind of implicit claim to deity on the part of Jesus. But he says, this is a new commandment, or this commandment I have given you. It's really, his commandment is a summary of all of his commandments. Now, if you look back through the New Testament, we could probably come up with a list of all that Jesus commanded. It would probably be hundreds of things. But if you boil them all down, it comes back to this one. If we love the Lord our God and we love one another, we're fulfilling all the commandments that Jesus gave to us. Now, if you look, "This is my commandment, that you love one another." Look at what comes before, though. If we back up to verse 9, Jesus has already said, "As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love." So there's this kind of cascading waterfall of love in the chapter, right? God has loved the Son has loved us, so we ought to love one another. So just as it's been poured out on the Son, it's poured out on us, and it should pour out of us to everyone around us. We've been loved, therefore we should love. This commandment is to love one another, but notice the means, or really the measure of love. It's in that last statement, love as I have loved you. That takes this command to a whole new plane, doesn't it? Because Jesus' love is a perfect and infinite love. We might say, well, if that's the measure, then I'll never live up. I can never love as fully or as greatly as Jesus has loved. But Jesus is giving us a pattern to say, your love should be modeled on the love that I have. So we ought to ask, what's the model of Jesus' love? How did Jesus love us? I'll give you two words. There's a lot more that could be said here, but I'll give you just two. Number one, Jesus has loved us freely. He has loved us freely. Christ was not compelled to love us by anything other than his own character. The idea that, you know, God was lonely or that God had some need, therefore he created man and loved him, is just preposterous. God existed from eternity past as three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit, in perfect unity, in perfect love, in perfect harmony. There was no need. It wasn't like God had some unfulfilled or unmet expectation or need in himself, therefore he loved us. No. Furthermore, there's nothing in us that's lovely. It's not like Jesus looked down and said, wow, what wonderful people here in Springfield, Ohio. I think that I shall love them. No. What he saw when he looked at us was rebellious sinners. Those who hated him. So when God and the Lord Jesus loved us, it was freely. Not out of an obligation or a need, nor out of our own loveliness. Instead, he chose to love us because he himself is love. He loved us freely. So what's the application there? If we're to love like Jesus, and his love is freely given, we ought to freely love others. Sometimes we fall into this pattern, like most human beings, that we give in order to get. You know, I'll do something good for you, but I expect something in return. Even if it's a simple thank you. And so we become kind of disillusioned whenever we love others, and you know what? We don't get anything back from it. There's nothing in it for me. Well, if that's the case, then you're loving like Jesus, because Jesus gave of his love freely, not because we had some great thing to offer back to him. In fact, serving in a church and being in a church, there may be times when you feel like you did your part and you kind of got snubbed, but somebody didn't recognize you or acknowledge you or thank you for the good thing that you did for them. Sometimes people leave the church over stuff like that. But we're to love freely, like Christ did. Also, we should love freely in the sense that we're not looking just at people who are like us, right? Well, I love them because they vote the same way I do, and I love them because, you know, we kind of get along with each other. In the church, we love one another even if we have nothing in common on a personal level. Jesus is the common factor. So let me say this, and I know already that we fail at this as a church, but no person at Redeemer Bible Church should be unloved. We ought to love every single person who is here. Now, do we? Not always. We sometimes fail to live out this commandment, but if we're to love freely like Christ loved, we love everyone who comes. Secondly, though, second word is not only did he love us freely, he loved us fully. Look at verse 13. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. This is a great verse. Sometimes it gets kind of lifted from its context a little bit, and you may hear this on Memorial Day, saying, here's greater love has no one than this, that these soldiers lay down their lives for their brothers in arms. Indeed, we have lots of examples of this kind of greater love. You think of a mom who gives up her life to protect her child. You think of a brother who steps in the way of danger to protect his siblings. We might think of the soldier or the firefighter who risks his life protecting others. This is a great expression of love. Now, if you look at the verse, it is a tad confusing, though, because it says, greater love has no one than this. I've always kind of puzzled about that, and if you look at how it's laid out in the Greek, this is a pretty good translation. Greater love has no one than this. And really what it's getting at is there is no greater expression of love than a person laying down their life. Jesus already said this back in John chapter 10. What did he say? I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. His love is to the fullest. And giving one's life is the greatest thing that we can give. Because everything else is short of that, right? I mean, if we give away our possessions, well, you can get more. If we give away our money, we can earn more of that. If we give away our property or anything else that we might give away, even our honor or respect. But our life is the last thing. That's the final thing that we might give. So the love to the fullest is expressed here. Again, there are lots of examples of this. I even noted that in the old Disney Jungle Book film, the animated one from like the 60s or whenever it came out, there's a scene in there which Baloo, the bear, sacrifices himself. And he doesn't really die, he comes back later. But in that moment, one of the characters actually quotes this verse. Greater love is no one than this, that has laid down his life for his friends. Probably the last time a Disney film is ever quoted from the Bible, I don't know. But that's the ultimate sacrifice. I read another story of a soldier from World War I. He and his friend had both enlisted together. They were very, very close. And in one of these fateful charges that happened often in World War I, they ran out of the trenches and were just mowed down by machine gun fire. And they get back to the trench, and his friend is still out there, wounded. And he asks the sergeant, asks him for permission to go back out and get his friend. And the sergeant says, absolutely not. It'd be a waste of life. There's nothing you can do for him. Well, the sergeant turns away. He's doing something else. When he turns, the soldier leaps up over the embankment, runs out into no man's land. And about a few minutes later, he comes staggering back, dragging his friend. The friend has now died. The man is mortally wounded, and the sergeant says, what a waste! He said, what were you thinking? Now, he's dead, you're dying, what did it prove? And the soldier, as he lay dying, said, oh yes, Sarge, it did make a difference. When I got him, the only thing he said was, I knew you would come, Jim. See, that's the kind of love that we think expressed here, but Jesus has the cross in mind, because he is quite literally going to lay down his life for his friends. So what's the application? Well, if Jesus loved us fully, we ought to love others fully. Now that doesn't mean we must die. If it comes to that, then yes. But to love someone fully means to love them with not just in death, but all the way up to it, right? So can we honestly look at our loved ones, at our friends, at those who are around us and say, I'm loving them fully? Or do we kind of have limitations on our love? Is love just a token that we, exercise just to sort of check the box? It ought to be true love, loving others fully as we have been fully loved. Greater love is no one than this. Someone laid down his life for his friends. That word friends there becomes kind of a key word that links us with what is here to what is to come. Here's the point, though. If we are friends, we've been given the greatest responsibility, the highest responsibility. That is to love one another. That's what Jesus wants us to know. That really forms the backbone of what it means to be a friend of God. Secondly, though, Jesus tells us something else. He issues us a command. And number two, the Lord has called you his friend. The Lord has called you his friend. I don't know if you did this or not, but in school, probably grade school, Well, it could have been middle school too, I guess. Kids oftentimes are passing notes around. And one of the notes that gets passed around is, do you want to be my friend? Check yes or no. I'm not sure why it was. We always had felt like we had to add the yes or no checkbox, but that was one of the questions. Do you want to be my friend? And I think we long to hear people say that. And we want to hear people say, I'm your friend. I care about you. So can you imagine how the disciples must have felt when Jesus says, you are my friends? Look at what it says. Verse 14. You are my friends if you do what I command. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I've heard from my Father, I have made known to you. So Jesus has just said, the ultimate love is laying down your life for your friend. And then he says, and you're my friends, you 11. And by extension, all of those who would follow Christ throughout all ages, he looks at us and says, you are my friend. I gave my life for you. We are friends of God. This is the greatest privilege, the highest privilege we have in being a friend of the Lord, that he acknowledges us as such. Now look at verse 14. It says, you are my friends, condition, if you do what I command you. Again, this might sound familiar as well, because we've read previously, Christ has said on more than one occasion, if you love me, keep my commandments. Now he says, you're my friends, you keep my commandments. It works the same way. If we claim to love God, if we claim to be his friends, it must be shown in our action. So being friends of God includes these three elements, and let me point them out to you in the text. Number one, it involves love. It involves love. This word that's used here in verse 14, you are my friends, comes from the Greek word philos. Also where we get the word phileo, means love. And we have it in our city of brotherly love, right? Philos, Delphos, right? Philadelphia, city of love, brotherly love. There are two words that are used in this text for love, agape and phileo, and they're used almost interchangeably. So this word friend comes from a loved one. In fact, we might even translate it that way. You are my loved ones. So love is at the core, at the heart of what it means to be a friend. And as I already noted, Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Now he rephrases it, if you are my friends, if you are my loved ones, keep my commandments. So if we're going to be a friend of God, it involves and includes this idea of love. Love for him and the love that he shows for us. Secondly, though, is the idea of obedience. But this is a bit odd, right? Because we usually don't think of friendships based on obedience, right? Friends don't give friends commands. Not normally, right? That'd be kind of a strange friendship, wouldn't it? Like, I'll be your friend, but you gotta, you know, check off the checklist. So, how is it that this works? Well, we usually think of obedience and commands as coming from a higher authority to a lower one. And that's why friendships usually aren't based on commands, because we're equals. But listen to what D.A. Carson says about this passage. He writes, obedience is not what makes them friends. It's what characterizes them as friends. In other words, they show themselves to be friends by obedience. And so do we. I mean, how can we say that Jesus is our friend and yet we completely ignore what he says and, in fact, do the very opposite of what he says, which would be disobedience? So imagine for a second that I was friends with a very powerful person. Let's just say the President of the United States, just for sake of argument. So I'm friends with the President of the United States. We're on a first-name basis. I can walk into the Oval Office whenever I want. You know, we have a great relationship. But then I go on my off time and badmouth all the policies that he has made as president. I deliberately go out and try and disobey the laws that he has signed into action. I'm not being a very good friend, am I? I'm not really showing myself to be a friend of the president if I contradict everything that he's been doing. And so it is. If we claim to be followers and friends of God, we must walk in obedience. There's a second element, though, to this, besides just the matter of authority. There's also the matter of trust. Friendship is based on trust. When we look at the Bible, there's only a few people who are called a friend of God, and one of them is Abraham. Abraham's distinguishing characteristic, the thing he's most known for, is a man of faith. He trusted the promises of God. Not perfectly, but he trusted. So friendship involves obedience. It really means it involves us trusting the one who gives us the commands. We do them because we trust him. There's a third word, though, that I want to point out. This friendship includes love, obedience, but also confidence. One of the benefits of having a friend is that you share confidence with one another. You don't keep friends in the dark. You tell them what you're doing. You talk with them. You share with them what you're really thinking or really feeling. Look at verse 15. Jesus says, I no longer call you servants. Now, by the way, that does not mean that they are not servants, right? All throughout the New Testament, we find saints referred to as the servants of God. But he says, I'm not referring to you as servants, for a servant doesn't know what the master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I've heard from my Father, I've made known to you. So he says, I brought you into my confidence. I share with you my heart, my plans, my will, my desires, my intentions are shared with the disciples. Now the word servants here is the word doulos. It means a slave. And slaves don't have that intimate relationship with their masters. They don't know what the master is doing. So the master comes in and tells the servant, I want you to set the table for 10 people, and I want you to cook the most delicious dinner you can. No explanation. No informing who the guest list is. No explaining what this meal is all about or what the purpose of it is. The slave just does it because he's told to. But the friend, in contrast, is one who is invited to that party, who knows the intention, who knows the plans of the master. Or to put it in a more modern setting, imagine you had a huge company and you had the CEO. The CEO is not going to go around and explain to every hourly employee, you know, here's the goals that we have for this year as a company, and here's, you know, all my thoughts and plans for what we're going to do in the coming years. No. They're hourly employees. They just get told, show up at this time, do this work, clock out. That's all you need to do. But if you're a friend of the CEO, he might share with you all that he's thinking and what he might plan to do and intends to do. That's what Jesus says. What I've heard from my Father, I've made known to you. All throughout the Gospel of John, we've been seeing this. Christ has been sharing with his disciples, here's what God's up to. Here's eternal life, that you know the Son. Here is the Father revealed to you in my person. He's kept them in his confidence, and he calls them friends. As a friend of God, we're not called to blind obedience. Christ shares with us his intentions. Now, we can't grasp everything that God's doing, but he invites us to know him, to know his purposes, at least as far as we can understand. What a wonderful thing to be called friends of God. We have the greatest friend, the one who knows us, who reveals God to us, who walks with us, who cares about us. And that really, isn't that the foundation of friendship, is that we care and love one another? I read a story somewhere here in my notes of a man named Sam Rayburn. Sam Rayburn served as the Speaker of the House in the U.S. Legislature, and he actually has the distinction of serving as the Speaker of the House for the longest term. At least I don't think it's been broken. 17 years he was the Speaker. Well, one day he heard of a close friend of his who had lost his daughter in a tragedy. And the very next morning, there was a knock at this friend's door. And he opened it, and there was Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House, outside. And he said, I heard what happened. Is there anything I can do? How can I help? And the man told the Speaker, he said, all the details are being taken care of. Really, there's nothing for you to do. I mean, it's all in the works right now. Rayburn said, have you had coffee this morning? You had breakfast? And he said, well, no, it's been busy, and I hadn't really thought about that. He said, well, I'll make you coffee then. So he comes in the house, and he's making coffee for this friend of his. And the friend walks into the kitchen at one point and says, Mr. Speaker, weren't you supposed to have breakfast at the White House this morning? He said, yes, I was supposed to, but I called the president up and said, I have a friend in need. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to make it. See, that's a friend who is there for you when you need him. And that is the Lord Jesus. He is there for us. It's not that we call him friend, although we do. He calls us his friends. He willingly identifies with us as his friends. So there's one last statement that Jesus makes here, and I want to point it out before we finish. And that is, the Lord has given you a mission. The Lord has given you a mission, and here it is. Go and bear fruit. So look at verse 16. This is the highest duty. We've seen the highest responsibility. We've seen the highest privilege. Now the highest duty. He says, you did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask in my Father's name, he will give it to you. These things I command so that you will love one another. I don't have a whole lot of time to go into all the details here, but notice, Jesus says, you did not choose me, I chose you. This is a great biblical truth that we find all over. Sometimes it's called the doctrine of election, that Christ is the one who first chose us. And this is the pattern we see throughout. We love Christ, yes, but Christ first loved us. He chose us, which, by the way, is the very opposite of what you would expect here. Because in the ancient world, disciples would choose their rabbi. If you were a disciple or a would-be disciple, you would kind of see who the rabbis were that were traveling around teaching in Palestine, and you would say, I like where this guy's going, I like what this guy's saying, I'm going to attach myself to him. So the choice was all with the disciple. But Jesus here says, it's not you who chose me, I chose you. Not only have I chosen you, he says, I've appointed you. By the way, when he says choose, you know, one of the things we're always told growing up is, you know, choose your friends wisely. Well, Jesus has chosen his friends. It's you and me. Then he says, I've appointed you. This word means to be put or placed. So in other words, we've been chosen by God to be his, and then we have been put or placed into an assignment, a task, a mission he has for us to fulfill. So let's look at it. Number one, or letter A, I guess I should say, the mission is simply go. Go. You see this in verse 16. I've appointed you that you should go. And this word go is very interesting. It kind of reminds you of the Great Commission, right? Go into all the world and make disciples. But this word, to go here, actually has the idea of going under someone's authority. So in other words, I'm going out under the authority of someone else. Being commissioned as a representative. So when we go, we're going out under the authority of Jesus. We're going out in fulfillment of the mission he has given us. So the mission here is to go in the authority of Christ and to complete our God-given task. What's the task? That's letter B. The task is to bear fruit. See this? Verse 16, I pointed you to go and bear fruit. Not only that, your fruit should endure or should abide or remain. This kind of connects us back to the discussion we had last time about the vine and the branches. Again, as we noticed before, fruit is never really defined in this chapter. It's never told, here's what fruit is. Some people think it has to do with activity, like evangelism and ministry and churches and church planting, that sort of thing. Some people believe that fruit refers to qualities of character, things like love, joy, peace, and the fruit of the Spirit. And I think it's probably unnecessary to limit it to just one of those. Bearing fruit, I think, is growth as a believer and growth as a church. As we make progress, as we grow to be more like Jesus, and through that growth begin to win others to Christ, I think it's all included in what it means to have fruit. So God's mission, God's purpose for us, that we be fruitful, that we produce in us the things he intends. Character, the action, the will to do it, all of it. Not only that, he says that your fruit would remain or abide. Here's the thing about fruit. Eventually, it sits on your counter long enough, it rots. And some faster than others. I mean, we've got a bunch of bananas right now that are, let's just say, past ripe. You know, they start to get brown spots and they just turn all brown. And eventually, you know, they end up in banana bread, which is where they're headed right now. But fruit doesn't last. Once it's been picked, you have a certain window of time to eat it, and then it rots. Jesus says, my intention is that you'd have fruit, but not fruit that lasts for a week or two, but that endures. To use a slightly different illustration, Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, compares the works of believers to wood, hay, stubble, gold, and precious stones. He says, some of it's not going to last. Some of it's going to be burned up. Those are the things that we do that, frankly, don't matter for eternity. But then there are ways in which we grow and which we do good that will last. That's what Jesus is talking about here, fruit that lasts. So how can we bear fruit? Well, letter C, the enablement. The enablement is prayer. It says, your task is to go bear fruit that should abide. Whatever you ask in my Father's name, he will give it to you. Wow, what a great blanket promise. God's going to give us anything we ask for. Well, two things to note about that. We've talked about this verse and verses like it before, so I don't want to hammer it too hard. But number one, this is not a blank check, right? This isn't just fill in whatever you want and God will give it to you. Why? Because a check has to be endorsed, right? And the name that's given is the name of the Father, right? The pray in my name, in the Father's name. So unless God is willing to endorse our request, we can't expect it to be answered. And so we can ask whatever, and God will do it as long as it's in accordance with what he plans and what he wills for our lives. Secondly, read this verse in context. What are we asking for? He's saying, our task is that we might bear fruit. Ask whatever you want in my Father's name, he'll give it to you. In other words, in this mission that we have to go bear fruit, whatever you need in that task, ask for it. God will give it to you. So as an illustration, imagine I give you a task and I say, hey, I want you to clean my house. You know, I've hired you to do this job, clean my house. But listen, whatever it takes to get the job done, you let me know and I'll buy it for you. So you come back a day later and you say, Reed, you're going to need an industrial level carpet cleaner because it's gotten really bad. All right. Anything else? Oh, yeah, I'm going to need, 4 gallons of Windex, and my house really isn't this bad, but, you get the supply list, and I say, done. I'll get it all. I think that's what God's meaning here. Go bear fruit, and if you need anything in that process, ask. It's going to be given to you. Not only that, we're friends of God. God is happy to give to his friends whatever they might need. So the enablement is prayer, and then finally is the goal. The goal is love. We started there, we end there. And I'm almost out of time, but he begins by saying, love one another, and then he ends, these things I command you so that you will love one another. See, it's a big circle. We love one another, we fulfill God's commands by loving one another, and by doing that, it's for the purpose, for the end result, that we love one another. And around it goes. The whole essence of the Christian life is fulfilled here, in that we love one another. Here's how Paul says it in Romans chapter 13, verse 8. Owe no one anything except to love each other, for the one who loves has fulfilled the law. If you've loved, you've done everything that's required. So we have to love one another. That means looking out for one another. It means caring about one another. Here in our own church, I see that so often, the care and concern that we have, but part of loving one another is just being aware. Hey, I saw that somebody wasn't here in church last week, and I care about them. So I want to know why they weren't here. Are they sick? Are they well? Are they on a trip? What's the story? We show love in a lot of different ways. And I want to actually close on this. This is actually an application and an illustration all wrapped up in one. So it's a good place to close this. Because the aim of being friends of God is that we love one another. So one way, if you're looking for a way to apply this love, here's one option for you. I can say this as a dad, especially. that one way you can show love to me and to my family is by loving my kids. When you love my kids, you love me. And when I see you, and then I see this often, when I see you take an interest in my kids and you love them and you talk to them and you engage with them and care about them, it's a blessing to me. I am blessed. I am loved well when you love my kids. And maybe you feel the same way. I know I'm not just talking about my kids. I'm just saying, I think every parent in this room would say the same thing. But if our task is to love God, the Father, how do we love him? We love him by loving his kids. You see, when we love each other, we're loving God. We're showing ourselves to be friends of the one who is friends to us. How do we get to be friends of God? Well, quite clearly through Jesus Christ, who gave himself, showed the ultimate love, laying down his life for us. You can be a friend of God today. Through the sacrifice of Jesus, through his blood shed for you, by trusting him, by believing him, you can be a friend. And friends love each other.
I think that's the answer. Yeah.